My name is Cecilia Mahone. They also call me Cece. I'm 76 years old. Today is Wednesday, February 2nd, 2022. I'm here in Tampa, Florida. My friend Linda Aston is with me, and we've been friends for a long time.
Linda? And my name is Linda Aston, and I am 63 years old. Today is Wednesday, February 2nd, 2022. I am here in Tampa, Florida, downtown. My interview partner is Cecilia Mahone. I know her as Cece, and she's an old dear friend of mine.
Linda, we were talking earlier about how different our lives were where we grew up.
Mm-hmm.
I started out in Jacksonville, Florida, and spent the first 8 years of my life there. And then I moved to Detroit, stayed there for about 20 years, went to school, went to college, and then I came back to Jacksonville. Oh, that's so different from you living in California, I bet.
Yes, it was. My whole growing up was in Southern California, so I didn't really, and I didn't live downtown. I was a suburban girl, kind of. I lived in an area inland called Hacienda Heights, was really desert-like, but my parents loved sailing and boating, and we finally moved down to Long Beach. So from fifth grade on, I lived down at the beach. My parents scraped and saved so we could buy this tiny little bungalow that was about 700 square feet, where my brother, my sister, and I, my mom, my dad, my grandmother, and our dog all lived in this 700 square foot bungalow just so we could live near the beach. And that was kind of, majority of my memories were living there on the water. And we were big sailors. Mm-hmm. And so we spent a lot of our time and my childhood sailing out in the Pacific Ocean over to Catalina Island. I have memories of, like, for instance, part of my childhood was my dad would insist that we learn how to swim, and the way we learned how is he would throw us in the water, and we had to learn how to swim. That was, I had to learn how to sail, so we had a little funny sabot, and they would put me in the bay in the sabot. There'd be no wind, and I had to go to sailing school every day, and I'd have to take the tiller and scull across the bay, and I would be crying. I didn't want to go to sailing school, and I would have to go to Leeward Sailing Club and learn how to sail. And, of course, I'm 63 years old now, and I have a sailboat, and I adore the ocean. That started out my love for sailing. And so my childhood was pretty simple. Honestly, it was going to the beach, going sailing with my family, where we would spend a couple weeks at a time. Just out on the boat, going over to Catalina Island and swimming and snorkeling and things like that. Let's see what else in my childhood. I was a big seamstress. I sewed all my clothes from the time I could sew through high school, through prom, college. So,
wow.
So those were kind of my hobbies. We were very fortunate. Dad was a civil servant, a police officer, and my mom was a state employment officer. So two civil servants, and we were fortunate not to have a lot of financial stress in our lives. And I, didn't experience, I'm sure, anything like, what your life was in Detroit.
Well, I didn't move to Detroit until I was 8.
Yeah.
So I lived around my great-grandparents and my great-grandparents. My great-grandfather was alive until 1963.
Wow.
And he had a house on the beach. We were on the Atlantic. We lived in Jacksonville, which is about 30 miles from American Beach. The company that he worked for established an Afro-American beach. And at that time, we were isolated, but we all had fun on the beach together. He built a house there in the 20s, which is still standing. It's not very stable now, but it's still owned by the family. I have a cousin who owns that house. And it was used in a movie the same way it was when I was a kid. When I was a kid, my grandmother would take us all to the beach. Grandpapa drove. Grandmother never drove. Grandpapa drove. And we could all go and stay at the beach. And we would go on, like, Friday afternoon. Grandpapa would stay there. And then he would drive back on Sunday night to go to work. And then we would be there with grandmother. Sometimes my great-grandfather came. And my first real memory of prayer was on the beach. There was a storm, and it was scary. The winds were up. The tide was up. And the house was actually on the Atlantic beach.
Mm-hmm.
So we were all there instead of listening to the Lone Ranger that night. It was the Lone Ranger, and there was two or three other programs that came on. Grandpapa was not very much into radios. And we never had a TV at the beach for years and years. We didn't have one. But I remember there being a light. We had a candlelight. And we all sat around praying because we didn't have cars. My grandfather had taken the car and gone to town. And it was my great-grandfather, my grandmother, and myself, my brother, and two of my cousins. And we were all little kids. We were like 5 or 6 years old. And there was no way to get away from that storm.
Yeah.
And it was just coming. And I remember we all sat around the living room table and said a prayer that storm would pass us by. And here I am, so it must have.
It must have, and the house is still there.
And the house is still there. It's there. And we all, every once in a while, we all get there, you know, and we go swimming and we go fishing and we do the things that you do on the beach.
Yeah.
Pick up shells.
Right.
We made custom jewelry. We made boxes with those shells. We did all kinds of stuff with those shells.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting is those were two different places, Southern California and you, but, you know, the simplicity of that, just going at the beach and collecting the shells, you know, that's a thing that we had in common where we just really had those were simple things that really made us happy. I used to make the jewelry with shells. We used to, you know, I used to try to get my dad to drill little tiny holes, you know, in the shells that I collected, and we would collect the beach glass, mm-hmm. that pretty beach glass, because we found a lot of that. And just, you know, putting our feet in the water and do whatever you do at the beach, making, you know, with the sand and just simple pleasures like that. So what's also interesting is I still remember when we were at our GOW prayer group, and I'm talking about, the movie that I loved, Sunshine State. And going on and on about how, you know, and I didn't know about American Beach until I saw that movie.
Mm.
And, you know, I thought how naive of me that I wasn't aware, you know, that there would be two beaches separated like that. Because that was part of the theme of that movie was they were going to tear all those houses down, build that golf course, blah, 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 blah. And then when you spoke up, he said, well, as a matter of fact, that was my great-grandmother's house, mm-hmm. you know, where they filmed that. So that was... I remember that was a big aha moment with me.
Well, we had fun at that house. And it is still standing. It was built in the 20s, mm-hmm. 1920s. And it's now a historic monument, I think is what it's called.
Okay.
We had to gather information and things. I still have pictures of my grandparents at that house. I don't have any of my great-grandfather at that house,
mm-hmm.
but I have pictures of my grandfather and my grandmother at that house. And then, of course, there are the memories of things. There are things that I have, dishes and sometimes ornaments, things that were in that house at one time, And they're now sitting in my house.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
So it's just, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And some of those, most of those things are not really treasures, except in my heart.
Right.
They're just treasures because they were grandpapa's.
Yeah. I still have abalone shells from, we used to dive for abalone over in Catalina, because we did a lot, that was the name of the island across Los Angeles there. And we did a lot of fishing. My dad would take me out fishing, and we would barbecue up on the hill, and we would dive for abalone. And I still have the shells that are just, you know, they're just a lot of memories, you know. So I can look at that shell, and then a whole giant slew of memories. You know, I don't even need a photograph. I just look at that, and it reminds me of all those times. Yeah. It was really a kick. It is a kind of an unusual thing in my childhood was my dad played the concertina, which is like an accordion, only it's eight-sided and round. And my mom played the guitar, and they always took them with them. Mm-hmm. And we had a big campfire where we would barbecue all the fish and all the people. It was a yacht club, but it was like a joke of a yacht club. There was no building or anything. We would all go up there. And everybody brought their fish, and we would barbecue the fish, and my mom and dad would play music, and everybody sang. And so that was something that we did almost every weekend. We'd sail over, catch our fish, you know, have our sing-along. The adults imbibed a little more than they should have. That's for sure. I still remember.
But they could walk home.
I was like 12 or 13 years old, and I'm selling drink tickets to alcoholic beverages. I thought, okay, this is, you know, watching the adults stumble down the hill into their dinghies to get out to their boats. But I have such fond memories of that sing-along. My dad's concertina started to disintegrate and fall apart about 10 years ago. And I finally just took it to a specialty guy in Miami, and he rebuilt it, and I've decided I'm going to take that back up and learn how to play the concertina.
Okay.
So that's, you know, well, so that's a memory of my childhood that I want to kind of relive.
I went to the beach several years ago, and in one of the closets were the hats. My grandmother was very fair, and she got sunburned, so she bought straw hats for everybody.
Okay.
And all the girls, everybody, had to wear a hat when we went out to the beach. When we just wear a hat, make mm-hmm. sure that you have something on your head. And now I'm very cautious about going out without a hat.
Yeah.
And when my sister came several years ago, we went to Tarpon Springs she wanted to see a dolphin.
Mm-hmm.
So we went on one of those boats that they have that go out. And I told her, I said, we can't go out just yet. We have to go get hats. And she's like, what for? And I'm like, you don't want to get sunburned. And you will get sunburned.
Yeah.
So now we have hats.
Yeah.
So that we won't get sunburned. Because as dark as I am, I have had a sunburn, and it's really a challenge.
Yeah.
So everybody has hats. There's hats all over my house. And the hats at the beach remind me of my grandmother.
Yeah.
And the fact that she wouldn't let any of us go out without hats.
The hat. It's the best sunscreen.
The best sunscreen.
Now, I remember you telling me you didn't know how to swim. And so here you were at the beach, and you didn't know how to swim. And tell me about the pool, because you started to tell me something about the pool, the public pool in Jacksonville. I mean, compared to, you know, I had a public pool that we all swam in, and in California, we had every walk of life. Everybody's, you know, I never thought anything about it. We had Hispanic and, you know, Asian and African American. Everybody swam at the pool, but you were telling me that you had a segregated pool.
When I was a kid, Jacksonville was very segregated. And the pool that the black children went to was in one area. It was the older pool. The white children went to a different pool. There was no lifeguard at our pool. So most of us really didn't learn how to swim because there was no one really interested in teaching us.
Yeah.
My father swam because he went in the Navy. But I never learned to swim until I was actually in Boy Scouts. I was a Boy Scout leader when Andre, my son Andre, was little. And at one of the day camps at the Boy Scouts, one of the leaders taught me how to swim.
Oh, my goodness.
And I was 40. And I'd lived in Florida most of my life by that time. But that was when I learned how to swim.
Yeah.
I'm not a good swimmer, but I enjoy it.
I just took it for granted. You know, everybody knows how to swim. I grew up in Southern California. There was no one that didn't know how to swim, you know, in my world. So, yeah, that's just really interesting. Well, what did you think? I mean, you saw that there were two separate pools. You know, what was going through your mind when you see this pool? I don't know. I feel so naive to grow up and not realize.
Well, racism is what it is. And if you know you're black, your family has told you this is where you go and this is what you do. You can't go over there.
Right.
It was just a matter of you can't go over there. And that was how I got into a Catholic school because I was ill and I needed care. And they knew that I had to learn to read and write because black children, black girls, were never told that your husband's going to take care of you. That's not likely to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You may form a partner, you may have a good partner, and he may work, but you still need to work. So I needed to learn how to read and write.
Mm-hmm.
And they sent me to a Catholic school so that could happen. The public school was good, but it didn't work very well for children who had special needs. And I'm partially blind, so I had a special need. So I went to the Catholic school and I learned about Catholicism. And I became Catholic when I was 8.
You think what a turning point that was, because your family was Baptist, right?
My father's family was Baptist. My mother's family was Methodist.
Okay.
When I was in Jacksonville, I lived around my father's family. So I went to two churches, Catholic Church first and then the Baptist Church. When I moved to Detroit, I was 9. And the same thing happened. I went to the Catholic Church, and then I went to the Methodist Church with my grandmother, because children didn't stay home alone mm-hmm. in those days, you know. I was a little girl, so you didn't stay home alone. And so I grew up in both churches.
Yeah.
Learning to I learned to be Catholic on my own and by myself. I went to the Catholic school in Jacksonville. And like I said, we moved when I was 9. They put me in a public school. There wasn't funds for me to go back to the Catholic school. But my stepdad, who raised me, was in school himself in Detroit. And he got his master's and he became a teacher. He was a social studies teacher. He taught in the school that was close to where we lived. And so when I got to the point of getting ready for middle school, which in Detroit at that time was 7th and 8th grade,
mm-hmm.
he said that I would never make it in the public school. At that time was the beginning of drugs. At that time, I think it was mostly pot. But there was a lot of other kinds of pills and other things going on in the school. And there was a lot of fighting. And so I went back to the Catholic school when I was in the 7th grade. And it was different. It was almost all white. There were very few black children there. And there was a lot of segregation in the school.
Oh, even in the Catholic school.
Even in school, people, rather than sit next to me, would put their books next to me so that all the books We went to Mass, actually.
Yeah.
First thing in the morning, that was how school started. And I was isolated, so I didn't have a lot of friends in that school.
That's tough in middle school, you know, when
it's
you're really,
really
looking
tough
for
in
peer
middle school.
Confirmation. Yeah.
It's really tough in middle school.
And yeah, and you know, and we're talking Detroit, you know, so where you just, you don't really think about that. You know, you think of the South and you think of the, you know, Selma and you think of, you know, places in the South where this is going on. And you just, you know, I just assume things in the North, you know, were much more, you know, contemporary and it was more unspoken. It probably just wasn't as outright.
It wasn't as outright, but there were things that went on. My dad, we moved on a regular basis. We moved simply to get away from the types of things that you think of as ghetto behavior.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we moved to get away from drugs. We get away from all those kinds of things. And when we finally, when they finally got up enough money to buy a house, it was redlined. In the deed, it stated that the house could not be sold either as a bar or to Negroes. And I don't know how much money I did. That was my first time of coming in contact with an attorney. My family had to get an attorney and get that taken out so that we could buy the house. We had the money.
Yeah.
But they didn't want to sell because we were black, because we were Negro.
And I think of the effort you had to go through, you know, and growing up in Southern California, I was aware of things happening south of the Mason-Dixon line, and I was kind of aware what redlining was, not to any depth. But it really wasn't even until the last 10 or 12 years ago that I even understood that it was happening in New York and New Jersey and all of the Northeast. It was just this quiet, you know, where they really had, I mean, like we've had this conversation about the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac would not underwrite mm-hmm. any mortgages if Levittown and all of that in New York sold to, you know, African-American blacks. They just said, and that was in our federal government. It was written in there. They thought it was too high of a risk. I just was so astonished. I don't, you know. And naive. Well, I don't know. It didn't make the headlines. You know, obviously, well, there's a lot of people that aren't aware of that.
Well, but it happened. It happened to us. And we had to, we spent a lot of time working on getting that part of the deed negated so that we could actually
yeah.
buy the house. And this was, now we're talking 1963.
Okay.
Because we moved into that house. I graduated from high school. We moved into that house. And then, I'm trying to remember, by that time we moved in at Christmas or New Year or something in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So then, and they lived in that house for 10 or 12 years. But it was a good neighborhood.
Yeah.
It was out near the U of D, so it was a good neighborhood, and by that time I had graduated high school and started college, and I stayed in that house only 6 months or so.
Yeah, you just
I moved back downtown because I was going to Wayne State, and Wayne State was downtown.
Okay.
And I started working in a theater and then eventually into a restaurant. My mother had been a dietitian and caterer. So I knew how to work in a restaurant. I knew what to do.
Right.
I knew how to serve food. So that was a good thing to do.
Yeah, I was. That's how I got myself through college was waiting tables.
Waiting tables.
Yeah, because we didn't have any money for college. My parents spent their money trying to live at the beach.
No, well,
forget saving for. But you know, California, you still, you know, I could work and pay for my own college. I could take the city bus mm-hmm. to the university. You know, so I was pretty fortunate that, you know, and my parents didn't graduate from college at all. My dad went up till almost to the end and then ended up becoming a deputy sheriff. And my mom could not, she could not afford to go to college. Soon as she graduated from high school, she wanted to help support her mom, who had been supporting her for so many years, because my mom lost her brother and her dad when she was 12 in the same year. And so the two of them had to live in boarding houses while my grandmother would teach piano, or they would move into a house to take care of other people's children. So finally, my mom, when it was time for her, she wanted to support my grandmother, and so didn't end up going to college. So, yeah. But they always said, you need to go to college.
Right.
You need to go to college. And so it was never a question about it. You know, you figure it out. I can't pay for it, but you need to go to, you can live here while you go, which was, you know, it worked out great. I always had one or two jobs at the same time and went to school and would take the bus. Worked out. Yeah. And, you know, it felt pretty good that I paid, you know, and they also emphasized no loans. You need to, you know, I don't care how long it takes. So it took me 6.5 years.
No.
But don't take any student loans out. You just don't want debt. So that was emphasized.
Well, that was the same with my family. My mother's mother lived in Detroit, and that's who we lived with when we moved to Detroit. And she never finished grade school.
Mm.
And she was the help. When I read the book,
oh yeah,
I thought I was reading about her.
Wow.
She was the help. She worked in someone's home.
Mm-hmm.
She raised their children. She cooked their meals. And she had a limited amount of education. And for me, she understood that I needed to go to college,
mm-hmm.
that I didn't need to be the help, that I needed to be someone who went to college.
Yeah.
And she helped in any way she could. I got care packages. My grandfather would bring me meals.
Yeah.
When I lived downtown by myself, my grandfather would bring me meals.
Mm-hmm.
When I said I needed furniture, she gave me furniture.
Yeah.
She helped in the ways that she could.
Mm-hmm.
But she was insistent that all of us go to school to get out of what they lived in.
Mm-hmm.
And all of us did. My mother's four children all went to college, and we all graduated.
Yeah. And all three of us went to us three kids. My sister ended up getting through grad school. I ended up getting through grad school, and my brother got it. He got his bachelor's and got an advanced certificate. But I just find it interesting, the parallels of, you know, my grandmother, who basically cooked, was the help, because they were so poor when my grandfather died. I mean, they lived in a stilt house. They had no running water. They had an outhouse. And she would tell my mom, you know, I'm going to co-live with this other family. I'm going to raise other people's children. My mom had to live with my uncle. But that was passed down as well. You know, you got to have, you know, I was left with no husband.
Mm-hmm.
I lost my son. I have no means. You have got to figure out, you know, something. And that got passed down to me from my grandmother. I was very close to her as well. So it's interesting. We grew up in so many really different places, but there seem to be an awful lot of things
that are very similar.
That are very similar. You know, parallel kinds of things. You know, I always felt like I grew up with a silver spoon in my mouth, but I didn't really. You know, I did have to work. I did have to pay for college. I did have to pay for my own car and my own bike and pave my own way. So it wasn't handed to me. I mean, the silver spoon was honestly the fact that my parents were really good role models for us. I mean, your stepdad seemed to be just an amazing man, you know, really like he knew you should go to Catholic school. Public school wasn't going to serve you well. They were such good models, you know, as parents. I forgot what you said your mom did. Your dad was a teacher and your mom was?
My mom was a dietitian and caterer.
Okay.
And I do science. I don't do food. I like food, but I'm not a really good cook.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom tried to tell me a recipe one time, and she said, add a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And I said, Mom, I'm the scientist in the world. You got to tell me a teaspoon of this, a cup of that. What do I need to put in to make it right? Because my mom could cook by the pinch of this and a little bit of that. She could make rolls by throwing some flour in a pan. Me, maybe I'm more likely to take Bisquick and do the Bisquick
wing. Right, just give me the directions and, yeah.
Yeah, just give me some directions that I can follow.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, it made me able to do a lot of things and to move around the country and to work around the country. When I was in Detroit, I worked with youth who just really didn't have anything. And I thought I was poor until I saw these youth who were really, really poor.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing I remember was the person I worked for was a PhD, and he was working and using these children as rabbits, testing. You know, he was just testing them to see what their behavior, could he change their behavior? And I looked at him one day and I said, I have to change other things. Part of me says I have to teach them how to be adults in the world that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
I can't just watch their behavior. And he spent a little bit of time looking at me, and we spent a bit of time talking about this. And finally, I started teaching health and, what is it, not culture, but I just started teaching them health and...
Like life skills?
Life skills.
Okay.
You know, just wear clean clothes, even if you have to wash them at night. Wear something that's clean.
Mm-hmm.
Brush your teeth. Here's a comb. Brush your hair. And the life skill class went on for the year and a half that I worked with those youth. And it made a difference. And I'll tell you one story that happened. I moved out of Detroit in 74. No, in the 70s, I moved out of Detroit. And moved back to Florida. And my son was born. And I took him back to Detroit to see my mother. He was a big boy, 7, 8, 9, something like that. We got on a bus. And there was a lady on the bus with this beautiful baby. And I didn't pay any attention. I just sat down with my son. And when I got ready to get off the bus, this lady stopped me. And she said to me, I don't know you, but you look like somebody I used to know. Is your name Cece?
Oh.
And I said, yes, my name's Cece. And she said, I'm Brittany or something, some child that I remembered being in this program. And what I remembered was a skinny little girl with no real, with all kinds of tattered clothes. And she had grown up, and she had a well-cared-for child, baby. She was dressed appropriately for what she was doing. And I'm thinking, she's clean, and she's careful, and she's... And maybe I had a hand in that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe teaching children how to take care of themselves was something that she learned from me, because she remembered me.
Yeah, isn't that great to see the result? We don't always get to, you know.
We don't always get to those results.
No, it's our prayer that we have that that we say that's from. Well, we're the workers, not the. Well, anyway, yeah. So we don't always.
We don't always see those results.
No, we're not promised to see
the results.
There were
30 or 40 children that I worked with, and she was the one.
Yeah.
That I saw,
yeah.
That I recognized. And I'm thinking, it's amazing to see that that happens. And
it
that
is.
I had some part in that happening.
Yeah. When I moved to Florida, well, I worked in the garment industry in Los Angeles because my first degree is in textiles and clothing, and which I loved because I just, you know, loved to sew, I loved to create. And I moved to Florida, no garment industry. So I worked as a real estate appraiser for almost 10 years. Oh, my gosh. To save up to go to grad school, and so that I could be a teacher,
mm-hmm.
you know. And some of my best moments, aha moments from being a teacher, was after I retired. And I still have, I run into students, you know, that I had 20, 25 mm-hmm. years ago. Mrs. Aston, I had one guy run, okay, he ran, came running out of Publix, Jimmy. And I had him in second grade, and he was probably 20-something years old. And he just gave me the biggest bear hug and thanked me so much for all I did for his family, which I hardly, you know, I remembered. But I wrote his mother a letter because his dad had Lou Gehrig's disease. And so I wrote about Jimmy, you know, so his dad would know what a wonderful young man he was, blah, 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 blah. And here it was 20-something or 20 years later, he's, you know, those are those things. Isn't it just miraculous? And your heart just goes like, oh, my gosh, this was so.
This was something.
This was really, it was so nice in my life to know that you made a difference in somebody else's life. It was great. So, yeah, and I do have a lot of students that still come up to me. Oh, Mrs. Aston, blah, blah, they remember
well,
this story and that story.
I don't see them as much because, you know, when I moved here, I became a welfare worker.
Yeah.
And it's a very different industry. And you don't feel like you have that much impact on people's lives.
Yeah, but I bet you did a lot of teaching. You were a welfare worker, but you weren't just handling paperwork, knowing you, Cece. You were handing out life lessons. You probably never stopped, helping them along. It wasn't just, I'm going to help you navigate the welfare system. I'm sure that was passed along as well. You just didn't always get to see the results.
No, you don't see the results in life lessons in this industry.
Yeah.
But what I have learned has helped me with what I'm doing now with working with the Homeless Coalition
mm-hmm.
and working with the homeless that we have there in Pasco County. I've learned to teach them to bring me their paperwork because sometimes I read it differently than they do.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they see this is all I have. And sometimes I see you have different things in different categories. And you need to read all the pages.
Yeah.
Sometimes the pages are really long and really complicated.
Right.
And it's hard because that's not what you expected.
No, when they come to St. Vincent de Paul, where you are there, the food pantry, it's more than just handing out a can of beans. You know, to so many of those people. It's not just, and then some people come and go, and that's all they want. But, you know, when you have to help them navigate some of that paperwork, it's, you know, they just need somebody other than a robot to hand them spaghetti and spaghetti sauce.
Well, and we can do that at St. Vincent de Paul. We
right.
can spend some time and hand out the life lessons. We're back to handing out some life lessons.
Mm-hmm.
And saying, this is what you need to do. And I guess the biggest complaint I have is people don't get very much in food stamps.
Oh,
they
know.
Expect more than they actually mm-hmm. are able to get. And I keep reminding people, even if you get a small amount, if you don't use it every month, wait. Use it 2 or 3 months. Save up what you have.
Yeah.
Use it 2 or 3 months down, and then you can buy something special,
yeah.
something that you wouldn't ordinarily get. And that's something that I try to give everybody the expectation that there is more for them if they just hold on to some of those things.
Yeah.
And they can't. The government doesn't give them very much.
Mm-hmm.
And it's written by people who don't understand poverty.
Yeah,
I don't think there's anybody in Congress who has to wait for a paycheck to get his next meal.
No.
I mean, none
of them. That's, you know, what I admire so much about you and Vera and all you guys. I mean, I'm in awe all the time. I mean, you've taken so many, you know, decades of life lessons, you know, and still in service. You're retired and okay. Oh, I hit the microphone with my, okay. You know, so I'm just always in awe of you guys that you're just, you know, and Anne and all of you guys just always, you're going to give back for the rest of your lives. You know, that's just.
You know, you don't stop giving
yeah.
when you get to be 60. It's just.
No, you don't. That's what I found in retirement. You know, I'm just so fortunate that,
well, the wonderful, you know, thing that about I'm with you retirement guys is that
working
my
with
pastor
the Homeless
has
Coalition.
My phone number.
Yeah,
you
it was know, one of the...
I never have time to stop.
Yeah,
my pastor has my
phone
number.
That was when we, you know, did the Homeless Coalition thing last year where we got all those people housed and all the all those goods. It's amazing. We were just a handful of five people, you know, when we got together, and the church, you know, donated so much. Anyway, so I'm just very thankful to.
And we serviced over 200
to be
people.
With all you girls.